to say terrible things are going to happen if. They are persons, prophets are persons who address their own time, who are preachers to their own time and period. And that, on the one hand, that makes the prophets difficult for us to understand, because you have to know a considerable amount of ancient history in order to hear the prophets in their power and force. So one of the things I've tried to do as we begin each of these sessions on the prophets is to read from a modern prophet, James Carroll, who curiously enough entitles his book Elements of Hope, even while he is saying some pretty dreadful things. And this morning I want to read the oracle called Cosmic Halitosis. From Boston's tallest building, where we come to see the sky, we look down on haze, on an orange cloud that separates us from our homes on the land. Boston has bad breath, I say to my friend, who says, better bad breath than no breath at all. We forget in our laughter and in our new pollution sciences that more suffers when we foul the sky than our sense of smell. More withers than the green plants we never thank. More than loveliness is lost when the air chokes with gas, smoke and fumes of carelessness. When our breathing begins to kill us, we have already killed something close to the heart of the human spirit. When we look down from the tallest building, we can find and see the fingers of poison vapors reaching for our homes. We have already seen more clearly than we liked the deep spirit of our city and of our common selves. Air, the ancients said, air is the principle of life. You meet a man intimately when he breathes on you. His breath is the gift of hidden spirit. If this is so, and if the common breath of our city is putrid, paralyzing our smell, destroying faint lilies and bronze heroes alike, what are we to think? How do you pour Listerine down a whole planet's throat when even your best friend wouldn't mention it to you? If taking in oxygen was all that mattered, we could air condition everything, trading Westinghouse, Frigidaire, Sears, and Admiral for the four winds. We could make a fashion trade in gas masks for when we had to be outside inhaling. If taking in oxygen was all that mattered, we could trade spirit in on engine and let it go at that. But how do you kiss someone through a canvas mask? Can you lift a kite on winds from Westinghouse? What kind of life would it be if you never lost your hat to a sudden breeze? No, there is more to air than oxygen, and more to life than life science. Air is where our fathers heard the gods at play, at war. Air is where we dreamed of soaring once, with the beating only of our arms. Air is where we met the limits of our land and of ourselves. Air, through flung glass early in the morning, blew the night's dust from our heads, carried instead the sun's fine grains of light and sparkles to the corners of our minds. When cities gobble up the sky's blue and hungry animals spit out brown, when our motors inhale fresh mornings, exhausting musty rush hour afternoons, neither our lungs nor olfactories suffer the most. Human hearts are the first to suffocate. From Boston's tallest building we look down, my friend and I, knowing that brown fingers separate us from the land, and, though we say nothing of this, from each other. The air between us was once made mainly of the breath we shared, but now, looking down on smokestacks from our air-conditioned booth, there are between us poison vapors we never chose. Boston has bad breath, I say, wondering if I do too. My friend smiles, and I think she's going to tell me something difficult, but she only says again, better bad than none at all. Well, I think that's a sort of fitting introduction to Micah, because this is an indictment of the cities and the pollution that they spew into the air. And Micah was the prophet of the rural poor, and a kind of interesting counterpoint to some of the other prophets that we have read. In the 8th century BC, that is from 700 to 600 BC, I was right the first time. 800 to 700 BC. I'm not very good at math. From 800 to 700 BC, there were four great prophets in the northern and southern kingdoms. Two of them were prophets in the northern kingdom, and we've looked at both of them. One was Amos, the herdsman and trimmer of sycamore trees from Tekoa near Jerusalem, who went to the north, especially to the king's sanctuary at Beth-El, and who prophesied in this northern kingdom. The other was Hosea, who lived in the northern kingdom and whose powerful word and sermon we looked at yesterday. The third of the great 8th century prophets was Micah. Micah, probably the youngest of the four, and a contemporary of Isaiah, but totally different from Isaiah. Isaiah was an aristocrat, probably from the nobility in Israel, certainly a close confidant of kings. He would be something like a cabinet officer. In America, I suppose you would think of Isaiah as one of those perennial advisors to the president. I'm trying to think of who the lawyer is. In
Clifford,
yes. That would be, oh, marvelous. A good. If Clark Clifford would ever say something publicly prophetic, you know, then we would have a genuine counterpart to Isaiah. Maybe the closest thing we've ever had to an Isaiah in Washington is someone like George Ball, certainly a member of the American governmental establishment who raised the hard questions and looked at the hard options at a time when everybody else was fawning around Lyndon Johnson and telling him mostly what he wanted to hear, which was not good for him or for the country. Isaiah belonged to that upper class establishment in Jerusalem. Micah, on the other hand, has nothing to do with the cities, with ruling classes, with power, and we will see that reflected again and again in just stunning vision and images from this, from the book of this prophet. I think of the three that we are reading, Amos, Hosea, and Micah, there's probably more familiar in Micah to us than any other prophet, and we'll see that as we get to read it through. Micah's name is an abbreviated form of Micaiah, which means who is like Yahweh. Any name, as you're reading the Old Testament, any name that ends with J-A-H or J-A, or even with A-H, is likely to have some relationship to Yahweh, a name that has something to do with Yahweh. And so Micaiah, let me put that on the board. See, if you just make a J out of that, then you get Yahweh. And Micaiah, who is like Yahweh, is the meaning of this name, and Micah is sort of a contraction of it. Micaiah was an earlier non-literary prophet who was Elijah's contemporary. Yahweh is my Eli, my God. Micaiah was a contemporary of Elijah, and both of them prophesied during the reign of Ahab. That is, they were preachers during the reign of Ahab. But this Micah now comes a considerable period of time later. He comes from the little village of Morosheth. Micah of Morosheth, a village near Gath. Gath was one of the five cities of Philistia, which is now the Gaza Strip. If you look at modern maps of the Middle East, the area that is presently the Gaza Strip was Philistia. One of the things that that our friend, the Prime Minister of Israel, what is his name, Begin, continually forgets is that at no time in Israel's history were they ever the sole occupants of the territory. Under the height of empire, under David, when Israel reached its greatest extent, geographic extent, it never eliminated the populations of the countries, literally, that made up the area. David had an empire, that is to say, Israel at that time ruled over many countries, but they were not eliminated. I think the book of Joshua gives us a false picture, as if Israel just went around slaughtering everybody that occupied the land until finally they occupied it themselves. They never did. You see, right up until the time that they went into exile, there were always other nations coexisting with them, and Philistia, the present Gaza Strip, was one of those nations, right there, in that territory. So when Begin refers to Judea and Samaria instead of the West Bank, well, he's not talking as historically and as biblically as he would like to have us think sometimes. Anyway, Micah comes from Morosheth, near Gath, which was a Philistine city. It was a small village in the foothills of southwest Palestine. And this helped to shape Micah's major message. It had two features. First, Micah loved the poor farmers and the shepherds. He regarded them as sort of the backbone of the country and God's especially favored people. And we're going to see how that works out in terms of Micah's message. And the second characteristic is that he observed international affairs as a villager. As a villager. What would it be like? It would be as if we were reading the columns of a pundit from rural Iowa, maybe a small town Iowa newspaper editor who writes a column once a week and comments on international affairs, salt and treaties and the Vietnam War and so on. Micah is like this sort of small town newspaper editor who looks at the city and knows that there's not much right with the city, and he's on an invasion route. Morosheth lay in the pathway of the armies that swept back and forth from Egypt to Assyria, and the caravan route as well. So it isn't as if they're isolated. It isn't as if they don't know what's going on. They didn't have television in those days, but they did have caravans passing through, and the news came with great regularity, in the same way that the Iowa newspaper editor is not isolated from television. But you look at things differently from that kind of a perspective. Micah received his call under three kings, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. And if we remember a little bit about the history, we notice that Jotham was the king after Uzziah. Uzziah was a contemporary of Jeroboam II, and both of them had very long reigns. Uzziah reigned for 41 years, from 783 to 742. The last years of his reign, there was sort of a regent who was ruling for him. He was apparently physically ill and incapable of handling the affairs of the kingdom. And so Azariah sort of was the regent. Azariah was killed. I think it was Azariah who was killed and so never took over the throne. And Jotham then becomes king in 742, reigns for 7 years, Jehoahaz for 20 years, and then Hezekiah had a long reign again, nearly 30 years in this period of time. So Micah was a prophet during this lengthy period of Judah's history. At the same time that Judah was having three relatively stable kings, it was absolute chaos in the northern kingdom. Yesterday I mentioned in connection with Hosea that there were six kings in a very short period of time, each one assassinated by his successor until the last one, Hoshea, was carried off into captivity. And in 721, during Ahaz or Jehoahaz's reign, Samaria was destroyed and every last vestige of the northern kingdom was eliminated. Now, so Micah observes all of this, a very chaotic period. He also observes Hezekiah's anti-Assyrian policy, which brought Sennacherib roaring down into Judah and eventually turned Judah into a weak vassal state. Micah looks at all of this as a villager, and we're going to notice this. Tekoa, the home of Amos, was only 17 miles from Morosheth, and it's quite possible that Amos exercised some influence on Micah. There are a number of places where there seem to be some parallels between Amos's message and Micah's message. I'll just note two of them. Micah 2, verse 6. When Amos went north, they said to him, "Get out of here. Go back and preach in your own country. Don't preach." Micah has here, "Do not preach, thus they preach. One should not preach of such things. Disgrace will not overtake us." An incident quite similar to Amos 2:12. "You made the Nazarites drink wine and commanded the prophet, saying, 'You shall not prophesy.'" Another, even more striking parallel is in Micah 7, verse 1. "Woe is me, for I have become as when the summer fruit has been gathered, as when the vintage has been gleaned. There is no cluster to eat, no first ripe fig, which my soul desires." And if you compare that to one of Amos's visions, the vision of the summer fruit, Amos 8, verses 1 following, I'm not going to read all of that, but you will see that there is some basis to the notion that Amos and Micah may have known each other, even though they uttered their oracles in different kingdoms. One other introductory reference, Jeremiah 26 refers to Micah, the prophet, in a very interesting situation. Jeremiah, you know, was a prophet more than a century later, and was a prophet at the time that the southern kingdom was coming to its end under assaults from Babylon. And Jeremiah prophesied the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. And all the princes and people, and especially the priests and the prophets, got very angry and wanted to put Jeremiah to death, until somebody remembered Micah a century and a half earlier. And if you look at that passage from Jeremiah 26, as they are about to put him to death, Jeremiah says, "Know for certain that if you put me to death, you will bring innocent blood upon yourselves and upon this city and its inhabitants. For in truth, the Lord sent me to you to speak all these words in your ears." Then the princes and all the prophets said to the priests and the prophets, the princes and all the people said to the priests and the prophets, "This man does not deserve the sentence of death, for he has spoken to us in the name of the Lord our God." And certain of the elders of the land arose and spoke to all the assembled people, saying, "Micah of Morosheth prophesied in the days of Hezekiah and said to all the people of Judah, 'Thus says the Lord of hosts, Zion shall be plowed as a field, Jerusalem shall become a heap of ruins, and the mountain of the house a wooded height.' Did Hezekiah, king of Judah, and all Judah put him to death?" Answer, no, so we better not do it to Jeremiah either. So Micah is involved here as a quotation, at least, in the saving of Jeremiah's life. And that leads us then to the discovery that Micah is the first of the prophets to prophesy the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, you've got to understand what this means. We probably don't have a city for us that has the same kind of emotional freight and religious impact that Jerusalem had. I think probably our own culture is so diffuse, New York is the financial capital of the country, the business capital, Washington, the political capital, Los Angeles, the entertainment capital. So we, you know, we don't have any one single city in which the whole identity of America is somehow invested. But we come close to it when we see what the French were willing to do to keep from having Paris destroyed. Or what it would be like, you see, if somebody would threaten to obliterate Rome, maybe for the Italians, certainly, maybe even for Roman Catholics of the world today. Something like that is what Jerusalem meant. You could predict the destruction of Samaria, and it would not be the kind of religious catastrophe that saying Jerusalem is going to be destroyed was. So Micah is saying something very, very radical when he is the first one to say Jerusalem is going to get it too. Well, with that kind of an introduction, let us take a look at the book itself. I think we're going to be able to read the whole of the book of the prophet Micah. It's half the length of Hosea, and I'll just try to make some comments along the way. The first part of the book, chapters 1 to 3, is divided into, divided into three parts. The first one is a kind of covenant lawsuit in which Yahweh brings a suit against his people. That's verses 2 to 9. Hear, you peoples, all of you. Hearken, O earth, and all that is in it, and let the Lord God be a witness against you, the Lord from his holy temple. Behold, the Lord is coming forth out of his place, and will come down and tread upon the high places of the earth. And the mountains will melt under him, and the valleys will be cleft like wax before the fire, like waters poured down a steep place. You have to think of a waterfall, you know, and the force of it, the rushing power that he is talking about here. All this is for the transgression of Jacob, for the sins of the house of Israel. And now notice, the key to Micah's whole prophetic utterance is coming up in this next section. What is the transgression of Jacob? Is it not Samaria? And what is the sin of the house of Judah? Is it not Jerusalem? The point that Micah is making here is that the city itself is the sin. Do you see how he's shaping his message? It's the same kind of thing as this small town or rural family where the son goes off to the city and everybody wonders, or even worse, the daughter goes off to the city and everybody worries about what is going to happen to them, because the city itself is the place of evil and wickedness and sin. That kind of a vision, that kind of a mentality is what Micah had, and I think it can raise some very serious questions for us. There is a lot of this notion that permeates American life. We had Jody Kretzmann here for 3 weeks as village philosopher and sort of resident urbanologist. Jody was doing sessions on the city, and he was saying to us, I think, that the city is a very ambiguous place. Without the city, for example, there would hardly be what we think of as civilization in the very best sense of that word. The city is the place where one can cultivate a kind of cosmopolitan approach to life, where there can be enough population to support musical establishments and centers of learning. I know in this country we have built some universities in unlikely places like Decorah, Iowa, and Northfield, Minnesota, and so on. But But mostly, if you look for the great universities, the great centers of learning, they are also coupled with great population centers. Without them, in one sense, there would be nothing that we call civilization. I remember this still from my own boyhood. I grew up in southwestern Minnesota, went to the local high school. They offered us a grand total of 4 courses in my junior year. One of them was junior business, and another one was conservation, and I think that we had to take English and general science. And we had 4 teachers in the whole high school, and there were 15 kids in my class. It was certainly a safe place to grow up, but my parents decided after 1 year of that that I had to be sent off to a boarding school where I could learn some things like Latin and German and Greek, and you couldn't get that in a local rural high school. There just wasn't enough interest in that, and there wasn't enough capacity to support those kinds of concerns. I think I was the only person in the whole township that learned to play the piano, certainly the only boy. I was always embarrassed to be able to play because all the rest of my friends and classmates in grade school were learning how to cultivate corn and milk cows and operate bundle teams at thrashing time, and I wanted to be like them. I didn't want to learn to play the piano. So, you know, you can understand. What I'm trying to say is that the city, on the one hand, is the place of broader vision, of greater opportunities, of cosmopolitan outlook and the bearer of our civilization. But, by contrast, the cities are also the places where we have collections of poverty and collections of crime, and where I think above all one sees also the dark side of the human experience magnified. I still remember the kind of shock it was for us to go to the Capitol in Washington when Jan and I first went there in 1969, and to see people just trailing after some important figure. While we were there downstairs below the Senate building, Abraham Ribicoff was getting off the Senate train and going up to his to the chamber to vote, trailed by people who just had the look of wanting to be close to power, of needing a favor done, of wanting to be seen with somebody who is important. And it was one of the most obscene experiences of my whole life, this sort of dehumanizing, depersonalizing sense of what happens to people when they are close to power. Well, cities are like that, you see. They have all the ambiguities of the human character magnified, and Micah sees all of that. The sin of Jacob is Samaria, the sin of Judah is Jerusalem. That's the burden of his message. Therefore, I will make Samaria a heap in the open country, a place for planting vineyards. I will pour down her stones into the valley and uncover her foundations. All her images shall be beaten to pieces. All her hires shall be burned with fire. All her idols I will lay waste. For the hire of a harlot she gathered them, and to the hire of a harlot they shall return. Much the same imagery again that Hosea uses. But now notice one thing. At the end of this covenant lawsuit, the prophet himself now steps outside of Yahweh's burden against his people and suffers and hurts with them. In the last analysis, this is the thing that distinguishes both Hosea and Micah from Amos. Amos is absolutely unrelenting in his fierce indictment of Israel. But he doesn't come from Israel. He comes from Judah. There is, I think, a difference in the way one prophesies if one is part of the enterprise, you see. I used to think about this when I saw all of these bumper stickers that said, America, love it or leave it, which meant, in a sense, to the Berrigans, if you don't like what we're doing in Vietnam, get out of the country. But I think that it was people who loved America deeply that were most hurt by what they saw of the country, what they saw of us doing to ourselves. In the last analysis, it does not blunt the prophetic vision, but it says, I hurt along with the hurt of the people. Notice how Micah puts it. For this I will lament and wail. For this I will lament and wail. I will go stripped and naked. I will make lamentation like the jackals and mourning like the ostriches. For her wound is incurable, and it has come to Judah. It has reached to the gate of my people, to Jerusalem itself. See, the prophet suffers with the suffering of the people, hurts with the hurt of the people, is afflicted as the people are afflicted by their own sin. You do not stand aloof from it. One of the things I think maybe that Christians are going to have to learn once again, and it may well reveal the genuineness, is that as judgment comes upon us, we will not run from it, but we will be able to be that group in the community that hurts and bears the hurt without despair. That's the characteristic, finally, of the prophet of Yahweh. In the next section, Micah does a whole bunch of word plays. And here again, it's hard for us to sense what he's doing. We have to listen to the word plays of our own prophets. Cosmic halitosis is the way Carol describes air pollution, you know, and talks about pouring Listerine down a whole planet's throat. Can you imagine somebody reading this poem 2,000 years from now and having to have scholars do a commentary on the meaning of Listerine, you see, maybe air pollution? Well, that's what we have to do when we listen to Micah. Here is an example. Beth Le'afarah in verse 10 means, Beth is the word for house. Le'afarah is a house where dust is sprinkled. See, it's a name of a village which has as its name house where dust is sprinkled. All right? Now notice how he plays on that. Tell it not in Gath. Weep not at all in Beth Le'afarah. Roll yourselves in the dust. That is, if we do the word play now, in the house where dust is sprinkled, roll yourselves in the dust, do you see? Pass on your way, inhabitants of Shafir, which means beauty. Pass on your way, inhabitants of Shafir, in nakedness and shame. The inhabitants of Za'anan, a place of flocks, do not come forth. The wailing of Beth Etzel, that is the house of neighbors, the wailing of the house of neighbors shall take away from you its standing place. For the inhabitants of Maroth, bitterness, the inhabitants of bitterness wait anxiously for good, because evil has come down from the Lord to the gate of Jerusalem. See, every one of these town names has a meaning, and he sort of plays on that meaning. The inhabitants of beauty will be clothed in nakedness and shame. The people in the place of flocks won't have any movement, any mobility possible to them. The house of neighbors won't be a place where neighbors can stand together at all. And the inhabitants of bitterness will look in vain for good. Notice these word plays in the utterance, the oracle. Harness the steeds to the chariots, inhabitants of Lachish. You were the beginning of sin to the daughter of Zion, for in you were found the transgressions of Israel. Lachish was the boundary city between Israel and Philistia. And what would it be? It would be like saying, what's the town just south of San Diego?
Tijuana.
Yes. San Diego, you were the beginning of sin to the daughter of Zion, you see, because it's through you that this evil breed from Mexico comes in, from Tijuana. That's the kind of thing that Micah is saying. Therefore you shall give parting gifts to Morosheth-Gath. The houses of Achzib shall be a deceitful thing to the kings of Israel. I will again bring a conqueror upon you, inhabitants of Marashah. The glory of Israel shall come to Adullam. Make yourselves bald and cut off your hair, for the children of your delight. Make yourselves as bald as the eagle, for they shall go from you into exile. Now he goes on to say that they will know foreign domination. And then at the end of chapter 2 comes a kind of sudden vision of a better time. Woe to those who devise wickedness and work evil upon their beds. When the morning dawns, they perform it because it is in the power of their hand. They covet fields and seize them, and houses and take them away. They oppress a man and his house, a man and his inheritance. Therefore, thus says the Lord, behold, against this family I am devising evil from which you cannot remove your necks. You shall not walk haughtily, for it will be an evil time. In that day there shall take up a taunt song against you, and wail with bitter lamentation, and say, we are utterly ruined. He changes the portion of my people, how he removes it from me. Among our captors he divides our fields. Therefore you will have none to cast the line by lot in the assembly of the Lord. Do not preach, thus they preach. One should not preach of such things. Disgrace will not overtake us. Should this be said, O house of Jacob? Is the Spirit of the Lord impatient? Are these his doing? Do not my words do good to him who walks uprightly? But you rise against my people as an enemy. You strip the robe from the peaceful, from those who pass by trustingly, with no thought of war. Here is the villager who watches the caravans go through peacefully and who have no thought of war, but it's these caravans that are attacked and stripped, and that cuts into the economy then of the little village through which the caravans pass and where they buy their supplies and where they bring the news. Here again, it's the villager talking. The women of my people you drive out from their pleasant houses. From their young children you take away my glory forever. Arise and go, for this is no place to rest, because of uncleanness that destroys with a grievous destruction. If a man should go about and utter wind and lies, saying, I will preach to you of wine and strong drink, he would be the preacher for this people. That is to say, if in his drunkenness he would say the kinds of things that you want to hear, then you would be a fit preacher for this people that says, do not preach. I will surely gather all of you, O Jacob. I will gather the remnant of Israel. I will set them together like sheep in a fold, like a flock in its pasture, a noisy multitude of men. He who opens the breach will go up before them. They will break through and pass the gate going out by it. Their king will pass on before them, the Lord at their head. See, this is... in the midst of all the doom that he prophesies comes this sudden vision of hope and peace. The third chapter is directed against the false prophets once more. And I said, hear you heads of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel, is it not for you to know justice? You who hate the good and love the evil, who tear the skin from off my people and their flesh from off their bones, who eat the flesh of my people and flay their skin from off them and break their bones in pieces and chop them up like meat in a kettle, like flesh in a cauldron. Then they will cry to the Lord, but he will not answer them. He will hide his face from them at that time because they have made their deeds evil. Thus says the Lord concerning the prophets who lead my people astray, who cry peace when they have something to eat, but declare war against him who puts nothing into their mouths. Now, these are the paid prophets, the ones who will say the good word to him who pays them, and who will pronounce evil against those who do not. I am terribly struck by this, partly because what has happened to American religion is that religion has to have an economic base to it. In other words, pastors, in order to get their salary, have to make sure that they have a clientele that will pay them. The result has been, I think, not so much that we have court chaplains, but that we have collections of families who are able to afford a chaplain. That is, someone who will do for them the kinds of religious things that they want done. Baptize and marry and bury and teach their children confirmation instruction and hold religious services and visit the sick. And we don't want our pastors to be anything more than the comforters of, that is, the chaplains, the comforters and the chaplains to a collection of families who can afford one. It also means that one tests the waters very, very carefully before venturing into anything that might be uncomfortable for the people who are paying your salary. So in rural Ohio, where there are a lot of ALC congregations, you do not say anything at all about the problems of migrant workers because the income of the communities depends upon having migrant workers, usually Mexican Americans, who will pick the crops that eventually come into the church coffers and pay the pastor's salaries. It's very interesting to observe how the ALC, which is very rural Ohio-ish, reacted to the march on Columbus of Mexican Americans and migrant workers, none of whom are Lutheran, of course, you see. Also interesting to observe how ALC people in the Dakotas and Minnesota respond to Indian concerns. I guess Paul is going to say something about that. Or interesting how Lutherans in the southeastern part of this country respond to the civil rights enterprise. I remember one of the most vivid memories I have of the whole civil rights thing was how Joe Elwinger, who was at that time a pastor in Selma, led a pitiful procession, could hardly call it a march, of 62 brave white people from Alabama just walking through the streets of Selma to the courthouse. And when they got to the courthouse, Joe's district president, the president of the Southern District of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, had already sent a letter to the sheriff of that county, and he was waiting for Elwinger and these 62 scared whites to read a letter from the district president denouncing Elwinger's march. And the sheriff has this, you know. See, we know all too well who butters our bread, we clergy. You know, that is our great problem. I know I'm not pointing fingers. I am talking about myself. I used to write brave sermons, and when the time came to preach them, I would look out at the congregation and see Will Henk and Emil Bolinski and Gertrude Lansing and Paul Smith, and I would either leave out whole paragraphs or I would say them in such a way that I knew I couldn't be understood, which is not difficult at all for preachers and theologians, and it gives you an enormous sense of satisfaction having said the truth without having to pay the consequences. When I read these things about how
how these are the false prophets who cry peace when they have something to eat, but who declare war against him who puts nothing into their mouths, you see, where you are very careful to watch who is paying the bill and before you you attempt anything courageous. I could tell story after story about this, but as you well know, Ohio has a very antiquated school financing law, and therefore the tax revolt in Ohio has taken the form of continued voting down of levies for our school systems. And in many cities and small villages, the schools have simply had to be closed for lack of funding. We have there's a big parish in a suburb of Columbus where the schools were closed from October on because they simply ran out of money. The whole community was divided over what to do. Lot of controversy. Newspapers, television are full of it. I met the pastor at a meeting and I said, well, I suppose things are very lively in your parish, you know, all the school controversy. Oh no, he said, we never talk about it. Much too controversial, you see. It would divide the parish. And we can't have anything like that. Well,
was it Arlington?
Pardon?
Was it in Arlington?
No, it wasn't in Arlington. It was a southwestern suburb. But I think the main point is that's typical of the way so many of us operate in parishes. We do not have the strength as a congregation even to disagree with each other and to be talking about the kinds of things that we ought to be talking about. During the Vietnam War, most congregations were totally silent on the issues because to bring it up would have been to have controversy, and controversy is the one thing that our clientele can't heck. So we know very well who butters our bread. Then the prophet says, if that's the case, therefore it shall be night to you without vision, and darkness to you without divination, and the sun shall go down upon the prophets, and the day shall be black over them, and the seers shall be disgraced, and the diviners put to shame, and they shall all cover their lips, for there is no answer from God. But as for me, I am filled with power, with the Spirit of the Lord, with justice and might, to declare to Jacob his transgression, and to Israel his sin. Hear this, you heads of the house of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel, who abhor justice and pervert equity, who build Zion with blood and Jerusalem with wrong. Its heads give judgment for a bribe, its priests teach for hire, its prophets divine for money. Yet they lean upon the Lord and say, is not the Lord in the midst of us? No evil shall come upon us. Therefore, because of you, Zion shall be plowed as a field, and now the first mention of it, Jerusalem shall become a heap of ruins, and the mountain of the house a wooded height. In the Missouri Synod controversy, just one last comment on all of this. The Christian News, which was the sort of anti-administration newspaper before the Jacob Preuss takeover, always used to have in there about how the synod pays its teachers to teach a certain thing. Whenever I was confronted with this, I was used to say, not enough, you know, my price is a little bit higher than that. But that was a kind of appeal, you see, that got to very many lay people. Oh, we pay these professors and we don't want them teaching anything that we don't want to have them teach, which is the neatest way of all, you see, of silencing the prophetic utterance. And what happens then is that darkness descends on the people, and it is a people without vision, without divination, a black day, the sun goes down, you know, all of those things. The thing I think that if we do pay our preachers and our teachers, we need to pay them above all to be utterly honest with us. But we hardly ever do that. I had a seminar in an Episcopal church where there were a lot of doctors in Columbus, and I asked them to tell me what one of their biggest problems was, and one of their biggest problems is that people do not believe their own doctors. You know, you pay a doctor, and frequently you pay him to tell you what you want to hear, not what is really wrong with you. I was absolutely astonished to discover that this goes on in medicine as well as it does in pastoral ministry, you know. which led Dr. Alsever, when he was doing the session here Monday, to say, how do you get your money's worth from your doctor? Well, one of the ways is to have a doctor who will be ruthlessly honest with you. That's what you pay him for. And I would think, you see, that if we are part of the baptized community and living out of our baptism, then our goal in prophets and preachers is to have them admonish us and to have them say the truth to us, because that would be what we want. It is the mark of the betrayal of our baptism that we do not want this and do not have it. Here we have now next a section that comes also in the book of the prophet Isaiah, Isaiah 2:2-4. And the question is, who wrote it first, Isaiah or Micah? The notion is that Isaiah wrote it first, but it fits Micah very well. Perhaps he is quoting Isaiah because it fits, again, the rural villager's perspective. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be raised up above the hills, and people shall flow to it, and many nations shall come and say, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between many peoples, and shall decide for strong nations afar off. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Rural imagery again, huh? And nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore, but they shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken it. For all the peoples walk each in the name of its God, but we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. One of the places in Micah where he seems to acknowledge the validity of the gods under Yahweh, who is God above gods. Now notice a beautiful section here. In that day, says the Lord, I will assemble the lame and gather those who have been driven away, and those whom I have afflicted, and the lame I will make of the remnant, and those who were cast off, a strong nation, and the Lord will reign over them in Mount Zion, from this time forth and forever. History is not about winners, but about losers, at least according to this prophet. A couple of months before the end of the school term, John Yoder was in Columbus talking to faculty at Capital University, and someone asked him what among other things, or how among other things, a Christian perspective could permeate academic life. And Yoder said, well, let's just talk about the teaching of history. It isn't that one has to tell the story as if one sees it with God doing this and God doing that. You just simply tell history differently. You tell it not from the point of view of the winners of history, but you look at the losers in history, and you do your historical work differently. What would it be like, for example, you see, if we learned our American history from the point of view of the Native American population, or from the point of view of the blacks, and asked, you know, who were the significant figures among the losing parts of our populace throughout our history? Yoder says that might be a more faithful way for us to look at it. Instead of memorizing the presidents, maybe we should memorize the genealogy of Martin Luther King or something like that. Well, I don't know. But it's certain that Micah says history has a different dynamic to it than the emperors of Assyria and the kings of Babylon. And you, O tower of the flock, hill of the daughter of Zion, to you shall it come, the former dominion shall come, the kingdom of the daughter of Jerusalem. Now why do you cry aloud? Is there no king in you? Has your counselor perished, that pangs have seized you like a woman in travail? Writhe and groan, O daughter of Zion, like a woman in travail, for now you shall go forth from the city and dwell in the open country. You shall go to Babylon, and there you shall be rescued. Exile is not all bad. There the hand of the Lord will redeem you from the hand of your enemies. Now many nations are assembled against you, saying, let her be profaned, let our eyes gaze upon Zion. But they do not know the thoughts of the Lord. They do not understand his plan, that he has gathered them as sheaves to the threshing floor. Arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion. I will make your horn iron and your hoofs bronze. You shall beat in pieces many peoples and shall devote their gain to the Lord, their wealth to the Lord of the whole earth. Now you are walled about with a wall. Siege is laid against us. With a rod they strike on the cheek the ruler of Israel. But you, O Bethlehem Ephrathah, who are little to be among the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to be ruler in Israel, whose origin is from of old, from ancient days. Therefore he shall give them up until the time when she who is in travel has brought forth. Then the rest of his brethren shall return to the people of Israel, and he shall stand and feed his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they shall dwell secure, for now he shall be great to the ends of the earth. And this shall be peace when the Assyrian comes into our land and treads upon our soil, and we raise up against him 7 shepherds and 8 princes of men. They shall rule the land of Assyria with the sword and the land of Nimrod with the drawn sword, and they shall deliver us from the Assyrian when he comes to our land and treads within our border. Then the remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many peoples, like dew from the Lord, like shower upon the grass, which tarry not for men, nor wait for the sons of men. And the remnant of Jacob shall be among the nations, in the midst of many peoples, like a lion among the beasts of the forest, like a young lion among the flocks of sheep, which when it goes through treads down and tears in pieces, and there is none to deliver. Your hand shall be lifted up over your adversaries, and all your enemies shall cut off. All of this is promise for Israel. I want to skip to chapter 6 and finish off with the oracles near the end. Chapter 6, verse 6. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has showed you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you, but to do justice, and to love chesed, here again, mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. The voice of the Lord cries to the city, and it is sound wisdom to fear thy name. Hear, O tribe, and assembly of the city. Can I forget the treasures of wickedness in the house of the wicked, and the scant measure that is accursed? Shall I acquit the man with wicked scales, with a bag of deceitful weights? You rich men are full of violence. Your inhabitants speak lies. Their tongue is deceitful in their mouth. Therefore I have begun to smite you, making you desolate because of your sins. You shall eat and not be satisfied. There shall be hunger in your inward parts. You shall put away but not save, and what you save I will give to the sword. You shall sow but not reap. You shall tread olives but not anoint yourselves with oil. You shall tread grapes but not drink wine. For you have kept the statutes of Omri and all the works of the house of Ahab, and you have walked in their counsels. And I make you a desolation, and your inhabitants a hissing, so you shall bear the scorn of the peoples. Ahab was the one, you know, who took Naboth's vineyard. The last part of the book, chapter 7, verse 8, is a liturgy of lament and hope, and I want to end with that. Rejoice not over me, O my enemy. When I fall, I shall rise. When I sit in darkness, the Lord will be a light to me. Last night, John read again from the Lighten Our Darkness book. Douglas Hall just has moving words in the preface to that book about how only in the darkness do we see the light. And this is very similar to what Micah is saying here. I will bear the indignation of the Lord because I have sinned against him until he pleads my cause and executes judgment for me. He will bring me forth to the light. I shall behold his deliverance. Then my enemy will see, and shame will cover her who said to me, "Where is the Lord your God?" My eyes will gloat over her. Now she will be trodden down like the mire of the streets. A day for the building of your walls. In that day the boundary shall be far extended. In that day they will come to you from Assyria to Egypt, and from Egypt to the river, from sea to sea, and from mountain to mountain. But the earth will be desolate because of its inhabitants, for the fruit of their doings. Shepherd thy people with thy staff, the flock of thine inheritance, who dwell alone in a forest, in the midst of a garden land. Let them feed in Bashan and Gilead as in the days of old. As in the days when you came out of the land of Egypt, I will show them marvelous things. The nations shall see and be ashamed of their might. They shall lay their hands on their mouths, their ears shall be deaf. They shall lick the dust like a serpent, like the crawling things of the earth. They shall come trembling out of their strongholds. They shall turn in dread to the Lord our God, and they shall fear because of thee. Who is a God like thee, pardoning iniquity, passing over transgression for the remnant of his inheritance? He does not retain his anger forever, because he delights in steadfast love. He will again have compassion upon us. He will tread our iniquities underfoot. Thou wilt cast all our sins into the depths of the sea. Thou wilt show faithfulness to Jacob, steadfast love to Abraham, as thou hast sworn to our fathers from the days of old. The question in this is to ask, how are we to bear God's anger? And what the prophet says is, if it is God's doing, then we can endure his anger without despair. For his forgiveness does not mean that we get away with our sins. His forgiveness means that in the midst of our sinning and the consequences, the judgment upon them, God does not abandon us. And that is why we, if we believe these words, if we listen to these prophets, will, I think, be able to endure the judgment of God without despair. That, I think, is the burden of a prophet like Micah.